What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Cohen and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is the fine historical fiction writer David Liss, author of The Conspiracy of Paper and the Benjamin Weaver detective novels, among other books. We'll also have visits from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Cohen and Too Jewish.
Shalom. This is the final week of preparations before the holiday of Passover, which begins this Friday night, and there's nothing that says Pesach more than cleaning, cooking, and preparing. While some might think that a non-Jewish holiday like, say, Christmas takes more preparation than any other festival, I mean, they actually cut down trees and drag them into their living rooms and set them up there to die for a few weeks. In truth, most of the holiday preparations for that December American bacchanal are actually not integral to the festival. But Passover? Passover preparations are actually commanded in a series of tremendously ancient texts, beginning with the description of the very first Pesach some 3,250 years ago. That's right. Well over 3,000 years ago, on the night before we got out of slavery in Egypt. In the Torah in Exodus, and then later in other regulations specified in Numbers and Deuteronomy, we're told that on the Leil Shimurim, the watch night of the 14th of Nisan, we are to spend the evening and perhaps the whole night telling the story of the Exodus from Egypt and our flight to freedom. We are to eat the roast paschal lamb, the leaping sheep of freedom, with unleavened bread and bitter herbs, and teach our children the lesson of slavery and God's redemption to freedom. And we are commanded, not advised, but ordered, to eat only unleavened foods for the week that follows, and to remove all chametz from our homes. If we live in Israel, we're to make a pilgrimage to Jerusalem to celebrate the Passover there. The mitzvot, the commandments, are quite explicit and very ancient. But of course, that doesn't end the discussion or the requirements. The rabbis of the Mishnah, which was completed nearly 1,800 years ago, and their successors who created the Gemara, finished almost 1,600 years ago, added an entire array of ways to observe the Passover that extend its sway into every area of our homes and our lives. They begin by asking what it means to remove leaven, chametz, from our homes, and they create a whole system that requires the most thorough spring cleaning imaginable, moving furniture and bookcases, unearthing closets, taking out every possible form of wheat or other grain-based products from our homes, removing and cleaning every plate, platter, utensil, or appliance that might have come into contact with leavening. That process of bedikat chametz, searching for chametz, mechirat chametz, selling chametz, and finally biur chametz, burning the chametz, culminates this week in a complicated observance. Now, once you've removed all the chametz from your house, you technically don't need to throw it out or give it all away. You can store it safely, say in a garage or a sealed cabinet, and then sell it to a non-Jew for a nominal sum for the week of Passover. This process is actually used in Israel for huge corporations like Osim that produced baked goods for the whole nation. Anyway, after technically selling the chametz, that mechirat chametz, by the way, I've always wondered what would happen if the Arab who owns all the chametz in Israel changes his mind and decides after Pesach not to sell it back. After selling it and searching for any leftover leaven, whatever is left is burned. The process of burning chametz biur is actually pretty fun. You gather the last couple of boxes of breakfast cereal, the leftover rolls or Pop-Tarts or whatever, and using a can or a foil enclosure or a chiminea or whatever combustion chamber you have, you burn it all up. When I lived in Jerusalem, I remember walking home the day of the first Seder and seeing small fires on every corner, some not so small ones, with people burning their chametz in final preparations for Passover. It was a great cathartic moment, casting off the last bits of impurity before observing the great rituals of this festival of freedom. Of course, if the preparations for Passover simply included getting rid of chametz, the holiday would be much easier. But it turns out there are many, many other things you need to do to get ready for the Passover Seder, the most rigorously structured meal ever invented. It means having matzah, the unleavened bread, wine or grape juice, enough for 4 cups for everybody to drink, bitter herbs in 2 different forms, hard-boiled eggs, parsley and other spring-like veggies, and charoset, the chopped fruit and nut mix that's made to look like mortar between bricks but tastes good. And all of that is before you even eat your meal. That's just the ritual foods. Now, the meal itself in Ashkenazic tradition includes gefilte fish, hot chicken soup with matzah balls, brisket, and other heavy main dishes. Interestingly, few Jews really eat lamb on Passover. Various kosher for Passover kugels, and if you have any room left, non-rising desserts. The work involved in Pesach Seder actually turns free Jewish people into slaves once again, at least in the preparation phase, and the post-Seder cleanup is no less onerous than the prep. And then, if you are Orthodox or conservative or hosting a congregational Seder, as I am, you do it all over again for the second night Seder. All that labor actually makes you appreciate freedom more fully, especially when it's over. Anyway, to play us in on this final Sunday before Pesach, here's the Siman LeSeder Shel Pesach, the order of the Passover Seder, the only table of contents you will ever heard sung in a lovely Babylonian melody.
Kadesh urhatz karpas yahatz magid rahatza moti matza
Passover also lends itself to some humorous musical cuts. Here's this year's offering. It is both an amusing and slightly terrible version of Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody from Eish HaTorah, the Baal Tshuva Orthodox organization and website. It's called, predictably, Passover Rhapsody.
Is this the real life? No end to slavery. Caught in Pharaoh's vile. No escape to reality.
Open your eyes, look up to the skies and see. God will redeem you so miraculously.
'Cause 10 plagues come, then we'll go. Blood and frogs, lice and boils.
Moses, you are dreaming. This could never happen.
To me, Pharaoh, let my people go to fulfill our destiny. With the Torah, we'll be free.
Moses, tell your God I've just begun. My heart is hardened. The Hebrews are here to stay.
Pharaoh, what animals running loose?
Soon you wish you'd never been born at all.
I see cattle dying, clouds of locusts swarm.
Fire and ice, fire and ice.
Plague of hail is coming.
Thunderbolts and lightning, very, very bright.
Days of darkness.
We cannot see, we cannot move.
Condemn this war crying fiasco.
Listen here, Pharaoh, let my people go.
Who is God? No,
we will not let you go.
Let us go.
Who is God? We will not let you go.
Let us go.
Who is God? We will not let you go.
Let us go.
Will not let you go.
Let us go.
Never let you go.
Let us go.
God in heaven, in his midnight, let us go.
The angel of death has now taken off
processed war.
Moses, can you take us out to the desert to die?
Jump in the water and watch God pop out fire.
Time to get the Torah and be free.
That was Passover Rhapsody by Aish with apologies to Queen. When we come back on Too Jewish in a few moments, we'll meet the wonderful historical mystery author David Liss, who has created the most interesting Jewish fictional detective since Rabbi David Small. Meet him and find out where the character came from and who the first Jewish heavyweight boxing champ of the world was when we return on Too Jewish.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. Do you ever say to yourself, I just don't know what I feel like eating? You know you're hungry, but for what? Of course, I could try to tempt you with a Mama's Pizza. It's got mountains of fresh cheese, acres of sauce, and a crust that's so flavorful. Yes, a Mama's Pizza is always tempting, especially when you think about its aroma just as it's ready to come out of the oven. And what can you say about our toppings? How about meaty, crunchy, spicy, fresh, flavorful, delicious? There's no doubt when your mind is unsure about what your stomach is craving, hearing about a hot, fresh Mama's Pizza might just help you decide. But I'm out of time, so I guess I'll have to wait until later to give you the details about the delicious cheesiness and tantalizing nature of a hot, fresh pizza. Mama's Pizza with four convenient locations. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish, our guest this morning, David Liss. One of my favorite writers, by the way. He's the author of five novels with lots more on the way. His first novel, A Conspiracy of Paper, introduces Hero, a pugilist, private investigator, and, ruffian named Benjamin Weaver. Was a New York Times notable book, got him the 2001 Barry McCavity and Edgar Awards for Best First Novel. His second novel, The Coffee Trader, moved us to the Sephardic Jewish world in Amsterdam. It was named a New York Times notable book, was on the New York Public Library as one of the 25 books to remember. His third novel, A Spectacle of Corruption, and which was a sequel to A Conspiracy of Paper, also became a bestseller. He's also written The Ethical Assassin, The Whiskey Rebels, and The Devil's Company, and more books still out. David, how did you decide to become a mystery historical novelist who mostly focuses on Sephardic Jewish heroes?
I was in graduate school and I was working on my dissertation on 18th century British literature and its relationship to finance. And I decided I wanted to write a novel, and I knew the 18th century pretty well. So I took what I knew and turned it into fiction.
You have a remarkable way of incorporating a lot of what would seem to most people are arcane facts, you know, how the stock market developed, or how multinational corporations first functioned, turning them into really compelling narratives. I don't know anybody else who does that.
The key is, I think, most people think of things like the workings of the historical stock market as being incredibly dull. And in a certain sense, they are. If you look at the technical aspects, reading about how these things work from in historical documents can often be quite tedious, but that's one level. And on another level is these are conflicts between people who are vying for incredible wealth and incredible power, and often at moments of significant historical and cultural change. And so the key, I think, to writing about certain kinds of historical movements is to keep a lot of it under the hood. And you reveal the human aspect, you reveal the aspect of characters, and you only reveal as much technical detail as is necessary to understand the characters.
You sort of reveal it as people would have figured it out in the time. It's a really interesting technique. You must do a tremendous amount of research for your writing.
I do, and I believe very strongly in trying to, as much as possible, imagine a kind of historical point of view or a historical subjectivity for these characters. I try not to write my historical characters as though they're modern people who happen to be living in the past, but to try and make sense of the world as those historical figures would have.
We will talk much more with author David Liss when we come back on Too Jewish, exploring some of the Jewish elements in his work and others in just a few moments on Too Jewish. Among my most pleasant and least time-consuming duties, I have the honor of serving as president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, which celebrates the memories of Rabbi Samuel S. and A. Irma Kohan, my grandparents. Once a year, the foundation gives a substantial cash award to an individual for outstanding service to Klal Yisrael, the total Jewish people. This service can involve any one of four different fields: unity, education and information, creative arts, or rescue. If you know anyone who might qualify for the 2012 Kohan Award, just visit our website, kohanaward.com, that's KOHANAward.com, and you can find the nomination form there. And while you're there, you can also learn just who my own grandparents were and who participates in honoring their memory today. That's KOHANAWARD.com, KohanAward.com. It's a good visit and a great place to learn about a terrific award and all the recipients.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft, and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, Kvetch Orkfel, please email us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit our website at TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website or downloading us from TooJewishRadio.com or from the Apple iTunes Store as popular Jewish podcasts. The Temple Emmanuel Pilgrimage Trip to Israel with Rabbi Sam Kohan, that's me, is set for May 30th to June 10th of 2012. If you want to go on this fantastic journey to Israel, there's a couple of places left. Please email TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 for more information and how to sign up. We welcome back the return of our randomly recurring Haikus for Jews segment, back just for Passover this year. Lacking fins or tail, the gefilte fish swims with great difficulty. And on Passover, we opened the door for Elijah. Now our cat is gone. That was a Pesach version of our Haikus for Jews.
Southern trees bear strange fruit. Blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
This year marked the 75th anniversary of a classic American song, Strange Fruit, made famous by the great black singer Billie Holiday. In 1999, Time magazine declared it the greatest song of the 20th century. Wow, I'm not sure of that, but it certainly was one of the most powerful and important and influential. And it was written by a man, Abel Meeropol, who is mostly forgotten today. But his story is an important one to remember, especially at a time of year when we remember liberation and freedom. Abel Meeropol was born in 1903 to Russian Jewish immigrants in New York City. Like many of his generation, he completed his studies at City College of New York, but then went on to study also at Harvard. Eventually, he took a job in 1926 teaching English at his alma mater, DeWitt Clinton High School in New York. Meeropol became active as a writer and member of the Communist Party. Many of his early songs were contributions to leftist arts organizations and theater companies in the 30s. He published some of his work under the pseudonym Lewis Allen, believed to be an amalgam of the names that he and his wife Anne intended for their two stillborn children. In addition to Strange Fruit, Meeropol penned other hit songs, including The House That I Live In, made famous by Frank Sinatra, and Peggy Lee's hit Apples, Peaches, and Cherries. Meeropol and his wife Anne are also known today as the adoptive parents of two children, Michael and Robert, who were orphaned when their birth parents, Ethel and Julius Rosenberg, were accused of stealing atomic secrets for the Soviet Union and executed by the U.S. The poem Bitter Fruit, about lynching throughout the South and even in the Midwest, was first published in the Teachers Union journal, The New York Teacher, though it is widely and incorrectly believed to have been published in a Marxist publication instead. The political anthem was inspired by a photo of the 1930 lynching of two African-American men, Thomas Shipp and Abram Smith, in southern Indiana. Shortly after publishing the poem, Abel Meeropol set it to music. A number of artists performed the song live before he gave it to Billie Holiday in 1939 at New York's famed Café Society. In an era dominated by saccharine torch songs, Strange Fruit was a scathing indictment of race-related violence in America, no less unusual because it was delivered by an unrepentantly defiant African-American singer. Here she is.
Here is a strange and bitter cry.
I don't know if you can say that Abel Meeropol's song Strange Fruit really changed history, but it certainly contributed to the anti-lynching climate that finally arose in America, and it helped fuel the civil rights movement. And in this season of Passover, when we remember the original civil rights movement, our Israelites seeking liberty and the freedom to worship as they believed in ancient Egypt, we should also remember this Jewish New York school teacher and the powerful song he wrote that made a difference. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert, head of the Israel Center here in Tucson. Boker Tov, Guy.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
We started talking about the West Bank and settlements and the issue of what's called settlements last week, and you made the delineation between genuine Israeli cities like Ariel or Maale Adumim, which are really part of Israel, neighborhoods of Jerusalem, Gilo. I mean, you know, there's parts of Israel that are, for all Israelis, pretty much all Israelis, part of Israel, part and parcel, the Kotel, the Western Wall Plaza, the Jewish quarter of the old city, for that matter. But there are other areas and other kinds of settlements. So let's talk a little bit about the kind, what most Israelis, if they understand the issue even, would perceive of as settlements as opposed to really part of Israel?
Well, I think the area that probably symbolizes more than others the concept of settlements as it is perceived by the world media and by most Israelis would probably be the area of Tapuach. Tapuach is an area within Judah and Samaria, within what people call the West Bank, that is mainly inhabited by people that used to be the supporters of Meir Kahana. Meir Kahana, for those of us that don't really remember, was, well, he was a racist.
Yeah, he started the JDL, was very active in sort of theoretically protecting Jews, and then he moved to Israel, ran for Knesset, started an extreme right-wing party in Israel. Kahana focused on expelling all the Arabs from anything that might be conceived of as Jewish land.
Right, and Meir Kahana was probably the first, and to my knowledge, the only political party that was defined as illegal to run to the Knesset by Israeli law.
Right.
There was another attempt to define another party from the left wing, Azmi Bshara party, but the Supreme Court overruled it and said that it's not legal to define them as not legal to run to the Knesset. So Meir Kahana was very extreme, and the people that live in the area of Tapuach are in many ways the hardcore of what people hear as price tag movement or the kids of the hills, Na'arei HaGvaot. There are people that believe in a very strong of religious faith that the land of Judea should be owned by Jews, and they believe that it is not within the rights of the Israel state, of the state of Israel, to give any of those parts away, because that would be against the word of the Lord or the word of God. And they're very, very physical and I might say violent on fighting for their perspective, whether it's against Palestinians, against Jews that oppose their views, against Israelis that oppose their views, and even against the IDF in some circumstances.
You know, it's interesting. As an American, we usually have no real clue what's going on in Israel. I mean, even those of us who are junkies for Israeli news often miss the subtleties. But really, I think that when you look at American media, the presentation is that all settlements are the same, all settlers are, you know, right-wing nutcases, and all Israelis support that, and all Palestinians oppose it. They may be right about all the Palestinians opposing anything Jewish in those areas, but certainly the rest of that's just simply not true.
Well, you know, I think that reality, like reality, is always more complex than the media and most of us wants to believe.
Thanks, Guy. And Chag Sameach, a good and kosher Pesach.
Chag Sameach.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi. And Mazal Tov on Gabe's Bar Mitzvah.
Thank you. Thank you very much on Gabe's behalf. You just came back from a trip to Rome, among other places, and we're visiting some of the wonderful sites, not only of the general city of Rome, but of course the Jewish community, which goes back an incredible length of time, more than 2,000 years. What did you see this time, and what would you like to talk about the Roman Jewish community?
Well, I was showing some...
I might add, we shared a meal there on a Shabbat Eve not too long ago.
Absolutely. It was a very pleasant one. I was showing some college-age Jewish kids around Rome and recalling my days there when I worked for the World Union of Jewish Students, and one of our active chapters was in Rome. and the diverse backgrounds of today's Roman Jewish community, which include, on the one hand, Jews whose presence in Rome goes back well over 2,000 years, long before the time of Jesus, and on the other hand, Jews who've arrived fairly recently from places in North Africa like Libya, which accounts now for a third of the Roman Jewish community, and Egypt. Those Jews are a more significant presence in Milano, but still a lot of North African Jews. And everything in between throughout history, from the expulsion from Spain in 1492, refugees from the Ashkenazic part of Europe who thought that they might fare better during the Holocaust in Italy than they would elsewhere. There are Jews with all sorts of origins, and it's a fascinatingly diverse community. But one of the things that really struck me this time, more than ever before, is that when you walk around the old ghetto, where there's a bunch of kosher restaurants, kosher-style restaurants, Israeli restaurants, a bakery with a giant sign you can see from far away saying, homemade cookies, kosher parv. it's all in English, too, which is kind of funny. Anyway, first of all, the area of the old ghetto is below the level of the Tiber. So it was unhealthy, malarial. Every time the level of the Tiber rose, Jewish homes would be flooded. They basically lived in mud. And they lived at the pleasure of the popes, who, in the great tradition of St. Augustine, had the attitude towards Jews that they should survive but not thrive. So there should be a Jewish presence, but not a pleasant or embellished or comfortable presence. So they lived across the river from the Vatican, in sort of inside of the popes, but they lived fairly uncomfortably from the time of the Fourth Lateran Council, although the ghetto took another 250 years before it opened, until Rome was liberated from Vatican control in the latter part of the 19th century, at which point they were freed, they could live wherever they wanted, et cetera, et cetera. What I want to talk about next week is some specific aspects of the Jewish Museum, which, as you know, is beneath and around the great, quote-unquote,
great synagogue,
because in Rome, a building that's only 150 years old is new. In fact, buildings that are 500 years old are new.
Yeah,
so.
It's true. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A blind man is sitting on a park bench during Pesach. A rabbi sits down next to him and takes out his lunch, including, of course, some Pesach matzah. Seeing that the blind man has nothing to eat and taking pity on him, the rabbi takes a piece of matzah and gives it to the blind man. Several minutes later, the blind man turns, taps the rabbi on the shoulder, and asks, "Who wrote this garbage?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. You see, matzah is very bumpy, and the blind man thought the matzah was actually something written in Braille, and never mind. The Torah readings on Passover are some of the most dramatic and interesting of the whole year. We remember the Exodus from Egypt in a variety of ways, in prose, poetry, recalling the sacrifices of our ancestors, and rituals we still observe. We use Torah during Passover in the same way we use the Haggadah at the Seder, to teach and remind and refresh our understanding of the great blessing and value of freedom and liberty in every possible permutation. Freedom is too easy to take for granted. We must always remind ourselves of its blessings. And we do so by celebrating freedom in word and song on Pesach. May we always enjoy the liberty to do so in this society and in every society. And may others who are not yet free become free soon. When we come back on Too Jewish, our guest, the terrific historical mystery writer David Liss, will reveal how he constructs the greatest and most devious plots of all when we return on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape
She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Attention, Arizona taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime. Direct your tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. State of Arizona allows taxpayers to receive dollar-for-dollar tax credit, not deduction, for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations. This allows them to provide scholarship for kids in K through 12 at qualified private schools. JETCO provides a quality Jewish education to children in need at Temple Emmanuel Kindergarten, Congregation Anshe Israel's Kindergarten, the Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy, THA. If you pay Arizona state taxes and make your donation today before December 31st, you'll receive 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax. Your contributions last year helped more than 100 children receive the financial aid they needed to get a Jewish education. Join over 750 supporters who gave up to $1,000 per couple, $500 per individual as a tax credit, and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income taxes. To direct your tax dollars to Jewish education today, please call 647-8442. You can do it on your credit card, 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Help give the gift of Jewish education.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
This year marks the 10th anniversary of the horrible Park Hotel bombing in Netanya, Israel, on the first night of Pesach in the year 2002, perhaps the worst incident in the whole miserable history of the horrible Second Intifada, the war of Palestinians against Israelis. It was on Erev Pesach 5762 that a homicide bomber, a Palestinian Arab Muslim terrorist, walked into the dining room of the Coastal Hotel and blew himself up, murdering 30 men, women, and children, and wounding 140 more who were in the midst of celebrating a Seder for 250 people. The Hamas terrorist was a West Bank resident of Tulkarm, just over the Green Line. The other Hamas Palestinian terrorists who planned the mass murder were sentenced a year later to prison and are now serving what amount to a variety of life sentences. You know, I visited the Park Hotel shortly after the cleanup. It was a sad and intensely somber experience. It remains for many of us a reminder of the terrible price that Arab terrorism inflicts on innocent civilians. May the memory of those who died in Netanya 10 years ago this week be a blessing. In sad and sordid news, a French prostitute has revealed details of orgies attended by disgraced banker Dominique Strauss-Kahn, the former head of the International Monetary Fund, and not long ago the leading candidate to become the next president of France, and a Jewish one at that. Not anymore. The prostitute told police it was rare to find men who showed as little respect for girls as the shamed former IMF chief. The woman gave her damning evidence to judges who last week charged Strauss-Kahn with complicity in pimping in an organized vice gang. The 62-year-old economist is accused of knowingly using prostitutes paid for by two businessmen who illegally used company funds to organize orgies in Europe and America. If found guilty, Dominique Strauss-Kahn may face up to 20 years in jail. Ugh. In happier news, a single shekel from the period of the Bar Kokhba revolt against Rome sold last week for a record spectacular price, $1.1 million. When it was originally minted during the period of the Roman Empire, the silver shekel represented about 4 days of a soldier's pay. The piece sold was part of an auction conducted by Heritage Auctions in New York City of 260 silver and bronze coins from the failed Bar Kokhba revolt. These coins are part of the whole sweep of history in that part of the world, said David Michaels, Heritage's director of ancient coins. The Bar Kokhba revolt can date the dispute of who owns the Holy Land. These were also the last Jewish coins struck for another 1,800 years. Experts believe that 5,000 to 10,000 coins from Bar Kokhba's short yet critical conflict were made between 132 CE and 135 CE, the three-year tenure during which the outnumbered Jewish rebels were able to maintain their beleaguered state around Jerusalem. The coins were actually embossed over older Roman coins because there was no time for the Jewish revolutionaries to set up a mint to smelt and cast coins. Now, since I personally own two of these coins that I bought years ago, I'm thinking that my retirement might not be as far away as I once thought. Let's see, $1.1 million times two. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, author David Liss. He is the author of seven novels with, we hope, many more on the way. His series of Benjamin Weaver and other sort of historical detective novels, which take us through all kinds of fascinating periods in history, have become bestsellers. He's also written a very well-received book on the Whiskey Rebellion. Tell me a little bit about how you began to explore the figures of the Sephardic Jews in England and then in Amsterdam that led to some of those novels.
Well, the Jewish population in 18th century England, and my background is with 18th century England, was largely Sephardic in the first half of the century. And there's really a big population shift in around the middle of the 18th century where there's a large emigration of Eastern European Jews. But up until that point, England and before that Amsterdam was largely the Jewish population was largely made up of people from the Iberian diaspora, people who had fled either in their generation or in previous generations, the Spanish and Portuguese Inquisitions. And I'm not Sephardic myself, but I was always very interested in Sephardic culture in early modern Europe. And when I first started working on my book, it seemed like a good opportunity to explore something I was interested in anyhow.
You took a guy, there was a well-known Sephardic boxer, and you kind of transported him to create Benjamin Weaver. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, there was toward the end of the 18th century, there was a guy named Daniel Mendoza, who was arguably the first national English sports hero, and I think unquestionably the first national English Jewish sports hero. He was a celebrated boxer, and when he retired, athletes didn't, it wasn't like today where they would, you know, live on their endorsements and were incredibly wealthy. He had no income after he was too old to fight, and he made his living as kind of a tough guy for hire.
Kind of a thief taker.
Yeah, you would, if you needed a bodyguard or if you needed somebody tracked down, you could hire him out. And when I first started reading about him, I read his memoir for a chapter I was working on my dissertation, and though I didn't end up using it for that, I found him a really fascinating character. So when I decided to write my first book, I took aspects of his biography, but I wanted to write about the early 18th century rather than a late 18th, early 19th. And so I took elements from his life and created some others and just kind of went with it.
Do you like him?
Well, I don't like him the way I like a person. I like writing him. I think he's a very fun character to write, and you know, every project I've worked on with the character, I've enjoyed doing.
How long does it take you to write a novel?
Depends on the novel. If I'm writing something set in 18th century England, it tends to be easier because I know the period very well and I don't have to do a lot of additional research. So I'm working on something new, like with the Whiskey Rebels. I really didn't know very much about the Federalist period before I started working on it. That took much longer. That took almost, I would say, almost 3 years from the time I decided to start writing it to the time I completed it.
The book, The Devil's Company, you deal with the British East India Company, which was a tremendously powerful institution, not really very well remembered these days. Tell us about why you chose to do that, and what does that have any contemporary relevance?
Well, I tend to write about moments in economic history, and I was casting around for a new project, and I was very interested, largely because of contemporary concerns, in the history of the corporation. And I wanted to know where these giant entities came from, how they evolved, and what they would have looked like in the early modern period. And I began reading, doing some research, and I became very interested in the British East India Company, in part because it was such an incredibly powerful institution, and how it later became, much later in the 18th century, this commercial enterprise became an arm of imperialism that essentially created the Second British Empire. And you know, the more I read about it, the more fascinated I became, in part because of how different things were done and in the 18th century, and in part because of how many similarities there were to the kinds of the nature of corruption, the sort of shady dealings between the business world and the government, the ways in which labor was exploited. You know, so many things, I think, really fueled my interest in that project.
You know, maybe I'm reading too much into your books, but when I look at the Devil's Company, the British East India Company, the influence of the corporation, the sort of international, this wasn't really a multinational corporation, it was really an arm of the state, or maybe the state was an arm of the company at one point. Then I look at A Spectacle of Corruption, which dealt with all of the political corruption, the corruption of money. It was sort of in a crude way back then, but I'm not sure it's less crude now. And that followed not too long after that Gore Bush election. And then the South Sea Island bubble and the conspiracy of paper, which somehow struck me as similar to the tech bubble or what happened with the mortgage bubble in 2007. I don't know if you're predicting what's going to happen in American society and world economy or politics, or if you just had happy coincidences along the way.
I'm both predicting and causing. You know, part of it is, I think if you write a novel about an economic crisis, the world will almost always serve one up to make you look prescient. Because, you know, crises, you know, come with you know, and cyclically. But, you know, for example, the Whiskey Rebels came out in, I think it was September of 2008, and it was about the first financial panic in American history.
Just seemed like the Tea Party must have been kind of right in line with it. But never mind, I'm sorry.
But then, you know, the economy tanked about a month later.
Right.
You know, and it's not that I predicted it, but I was really interested in the economic climate at the birth of the country and the different factions that were vying for control of the government and the economy and the kinds of rhetoric that was used to discuss or to frame the various factions. And of course, it's impossible not to see these historical movements through the lens of contemporary concerns. And I think, you know, sometimes I will, you know, deliberately draw the reader's attention to the ways in which things are similar, were similar then to what we have now. And other times it's purely coincidental that you know, history serves up something that makes me look like I saw something coming when I really didn't.
So you mean there's volatility at all times, and it's you just got to write something dramatic and pessimistic and you'll capture the spirit one way or the other?
I think so, yeah.
What's your next project?
Right now I'm working on a novel that is set in 18th century Lisbon, and it is about the Portuguese Inquisition, which is the last surviving serious Inquisition in Europe. It was still going strong by the mid-18th century. Mm. And it is about a man who escapes from the Inquisition as a child and comes back as an adult to essentially seeking revenge.
So a secret Jew who escapes the Inquisition and comes back seeking revenge.
I would say not a secret Jew so much as a new Christian. One of the things I've really come to believe in through doing research on this project is that by the 18th century there were no secret Jews. That Judaism only existed as a concept because the Inquisition kept it alive.
Fascinating. The Judaism in the Iberian Peninsula, yeah, wherever the Inquisition,
yeah,
was.
That new Christians were people of Jewish ancestry who had converted but were not allowed to intermarry with the rest of the population. They were not allowed to leave the country, and they were essentially kept around as a kind of merchant class to be farmed by the Inquisition. If somebody, they would arrest people periodically because they could then confiscate their wealth.
Which is a very ancient royal practice in Europe that really only ended, you say, in the middle of the 18th century. Last question. How do you do your Jewish research? How do you find out the stuff about the details of daily Sephardic life, whether it's the 17th century or 18th century in England, 18th century in Amsterdam?
Well, I would say I do that pretty much the same way I do all other research. It's a combination of library and archival work and a certain amount of on-site research, you know, what you learn when you actually go to the locations where a book takes place. And with any luck, hopefully talking to experts as well.
So I have to say, you've come a long way from being an encyclopedia salesman. Do you ever regret not finishing your PhD?
No. Now, if I could find a way to quit again, I would.
Spoken like a true former graduate student.
Yeah.
And that was okay with your parents?
Well, you know, my parents weren't paying for it, so it was really none of their business. you know, my feeling was at the time that I got an incredible education when I was at getting my doctorate at Columbia. I don't think we obviously didn't study creative writing, but I don't think I would have been able to figure out how to write a novel without the analytical thinking skills I got in that program. But that said, once I sold my first book, I wanted to keep writing fiction, and I didn't need a degree for anything. So I had a choice between getting started on my next book or spending, you know, 6 months or 9 months working on a project that was more or less meaningless to me. So I don't really regret it.
Well, keep writing those books. And, you know, I can see a movie deal in the future somewhere.
Well, the Benjamin Weaver novels are already in development for film projects. And so is The Coffee Trader. So hopefully something will actually get made. Selling movie rights, it's like somebody giving you a lot of money to hold a lottery ticket.
Kind of the reverse process.
Yeah.
Seems to fit very much in with your normal milieu.
Yeah, it's all about chance.
Absolutely. Thanks, David, for a great visit here on Two Jewish.
Well, thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out on Two Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Israeli journalist Alon Vilon. Great interview, by the way. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or our TwoJewishRadio.com website and like us on Facebook. Our playout from our Passover playlist are particularly pleasurable passages of Pesach song. Here is Sephardic icon Yehoram Gaon singing the classic Ladino song, Quien supiense y en quien dense. Who knows one? The concluding song to many a Passover Seder in one version or another, coming up this Friday, and for many of you also Saturday night. My friends, have a Chag Pesach Sameach, a happy holiday of Passover, and a Shavua Tov, a good week of peace.
Quien supiense y entendiense alabar al Dios creyense, cual es el uno, cual es el uno, uno.
es el criador, uno es el criador, uno es el criador, Baruch Hu Baruch Shemo. Quien supiense y entendiense alabar al Dios creyense, ¿cuáles son los dos? ¿Cuáles son los dos? Dos Moshe y Aarón, uno es el criador, uno es el criador, Baruch Hu Baruch Shemo. Quien supiense y entendiense alabar al Dios creyense, ¿cuáles son los tres? ¿Cuáles son los tres? Tres nuestros padres son, dos Moshe y Aarón. Uno es el criador, uno es el criador, Baruch Hu Baruch Shemo. Quien supiense y entendiense alabar al Dios creyense, ¿cuáles son los cuatro? ¿Cuáles son los cuatro? Cuatro madres de Israel, tres nuestros padres son, dos Moshe y Aarón. Uno es el criador, uno es el criador, Baruch Hu Baruch Shemo. Quien supiense y entendiense alabar al Dios creyense, ¿cuáles son los cinco? ¿Cuáles son los cinco? Cinco libros de la ley, cuatro madres de Israel, tres nuestros padres son.